But it's not just about storage and storage cost, it's about easier access to content in storage systems. And that easier access and movement of data is one of the drivers behind the change in the position of archives within the production, post-production, and distribution process, and the much easier access to content that that brings, and potentially the benefits to preservation as well. And as well as increased access to content for professional reuse, there's of course the drive for increased access to content using IT for public use. And other presenters will talk more about this later this morning. And if better access or lower storage costs aren't your thing, then maybe you're more worried about your existing holdings and the deterioration or fragility of that material, or the need to address technical obsolescence. And this applies just as much to older analog formats as more recent digital formats, for example, digital video. And these things together, the promise of IT solutions for lower cost, less space, easier access to content, operated by fewer staff, the move away from needing to do big manual migration projects of items on shelves, and indeed the ability to perhaps improve preservation by moving preservation closer to the original digital content as it's being created and be able to capture more technical or descriptive metadata. All those things are benefits of using IT storage systems. But the question is, are they safe? If you put files into an IT system, what is the probability of being able to get them out again in 50 years' time? And if you can get them back out, are they going to match the thing that you put in to start with, either at the bit level or at the visual or audio level? So some more trends for you. Whilst storage capacity is increasing at a fantastic rate, that's not matched by the lifetime, the longevity of storage technology. And that applies both to individual technologies and generations within a technology. And a good example here is data tape. So LTO5 has now gone into widespread use. And there's recently been published the 8th generation LTO data tape roadmap. So data tape is here for some time to come. But if you're moving to the current or the latest generation of data tape in order to take advantage of having more storage for your money, then you can't use your existing drives. You have to buy new drives for new tapes. And if you continue down that line, then your older data tapes are soon not readable or writable in the modern drives. They've essentially become obsolete within approximately 6 years. And that sort of obsolescence, that problem, is everywhere in IT at all levels of the storage and access stack. So there's a need for continual migration on different timescales at different levels. And there's several things to note here. First, the need for automation to ensure that migration can be done efficiently at low cost and ideally without any errors. And secondly, that if you don't do that migration, if you leave the content untouched for any significant length of time, and there's a significant risk of loss. And that's in great contrast to traditional approaches of archiving, having items on shelves, where 10, 20 years, there's still a good chance that you can access the content afterwards. The same isn't true for IT storage. So looking in a bit more detail at some of the other problems with IT storage systems, for example, hard disk drives. Whilst capacity is increasing at a fantastic rate, the ability to read data from these drives without errors isn't keeping pace. So the uncorrectable error rate of reading data from a raw hard drive is about 1 bit in 10 to the 14, which is an unbelievably small number. Hard drives are fantastic pieces of engineering, but equally, an uncompressed film or HD video contains a lot of bits, and you're now at the point that there's a significant probability of seeing errors if you read that data from an individual hard drive. Indeed, as capacity increases, it's soon going to be more likely than not that you will get an error when moving data from one hard drive to another. And then the lifetime of those hard drives, whilst manufacturers will quote figures like mean time to failure of 1,000,000 hours, which is about 100 years, that doesn't mean that a hard drive will last anywhere near 100 years. And it certainly doesn't mean that you might expect only 1% of the hard drives to fail on average each year. A lifetime of a hard drive is about 5 years. If you use a hard drive beyond 5 years, then there's a significantly increased chance of data loss or failure of that drive or obsolescence of that drive within its system. So then the question becomes, well, within that 5-year lifetime, what are the reliability of drives? And here, big field studies of hard drives in real-world systems by Google and NetApp and others suggest that it's typical to see an annual failure rate of hard drives at about 5%. The interesting thing for archiving is that this failure rate can actually be higher as you lower the temperature of the drives and can be higher as you lower the use of the drives. And that's in complete contrast with traditional items on shelves archiving. So the last thing you should probably do is try and take traditional archiving approaches and apply them to hard drive technology. Don't put hard drives on shelves. And if you don't recognize that as a problem, the IT industry certainly does. And that's why the IT industry has approaches like RAID, which accommodates failures in individual disk drives or errors when reading data. But because the ability to read data from drives without errors, or the speed at which you can read data from drives, isn't keeping pace with the increase in capacity, then the complexity of these new systems to manage that problem is just going up. And that increased complexity brings with it another set of problems. So in the very systems, RAID systems that are designed to protect against errors, you get another set of problems. So a field study by CERN, writing 2 gigabyte files to and from hard disk servers, about a petabyte in total over 6 months, found silent and permanent corruption of data. At about the 1 bit in 10 to the 9 level, which is considerably worse than for individual drives. And if you want to know more about this problem, I'd recommend David Rosenthal's blog for a good roundup of these issues. But the point is that these silent bit rot problems exist, and you'll only notice them if you know that they exist and you know how to look for it. You can, of course, try and reduce the probability of loss, but that brings with it an extra cost, and that extra cost is disproportionate to the reduction in loss. It becomes hugely expensive to build very, very reliable IT systems. And, of course, there's a cost if you don't reduce that loss. So here are 2 JPEG 2000 images taken from Volker Heidegger's excellent work on file formats, the sensitivity to this bit rot problem. And both JPEG 2000 images have got 1 byte corrupted in the entire image. And if that byte is in the wrong place, then the results can obviously be catastrophic. So very, very small percentages of corruption to compressed images can have huge impact on the decoded result. And lossless compression doesn't make it any better. Indeed, any sort of compression shows this sort of problem, be it data compression in zip files or image compression. And most preservation formats for video or film are essentially a sequence of images, for example, if you use intraframe encoding. And the only way to have files which are in any sense resilient to data corruption is not to use compression at all. So the question is, what can you do about these sorts of problems? And here it's a question of following typical good preservation practice of having multiple copies on different technologies in different locations, ideally operated by different people, monitoring and correcting failures in those copies, migrating to address obsolescence at all levels in the IT stack, But all those activities have a cost. And recognizing that all these activities have a cost then allow you to compare all the different solutions and make some sort of judgment on the best approach. So in this picture, you start with two good copies, shown in green, and you'd have migration as an ongoing process to maintain those two good copies. But there's always the chance that one of those copies is damaged or corrupted for some reason, shown in orange. But you can't do anything about that until you detect it. You can't repair it until you found the problem, which is shown in yellow. And that gives you the opportunity to go back to two good copies. But at any time in that cycle, if there's a problem with the other copy, then of course you put yourself at risk of having two damaged or lost copies, and hence the content has gone forever. So within this sort of model, this sort of framework, you can then look at the different options. Longer-lived technology, that reduces the need for migration and lowers the cost there. More reliable technology, reducing the need to check so often and repair so often. Making more copies. Making the content itself more resilient to corruption. Maybe not necessarily correcting everything to a bit perfect level, but concealing problems. So content will last longer. And then, ideally, just checking often and fixing quickly. So if we look at some of these in turn, long-lived media reduces the need for migration and is ideally safer. But unless you're really careful with choosing a very simple and open format, then there's always the risk that you've moved the problem. It's gone away from being a technology problem, and it's more of a problem of lock-in to a particular vendor and the longevity of that vendor. And that's illustrated quite nicely by Plasmon and Inphase and other people who produce media that may last 50 years, but the company certainly doesn't. In terms of more reliable storage technology, I've concentrated quite a lot so far on hard drives, but you have to mention data tape, and that's considerably safer, at least in comparison. And experience by archives, certainly large archives, in using data tape, that when they do migrations, for example, between generations of data tape, the problem rates are relatively low, but they do exist. But for those archives who've had multiple copies and they actively manage integrity, they've been shown not to lose any content, which is encouraging, except for data tape has an upfront cost in the systems that you need to buy, the tape libraries and robots that automate the migration process, which means it's not necessarily the most affordable option for the smaller archives, where hard drive solutions have a lower cost of entry and are more attractive, and becoming increasingly competitive from a cost point of view with data tape. But those are the very systems which are less safe and are probably going to be used by the very people who are going to be less aware of the problems with those systems. And these tipping points, the points at which you go between tape and drives or a combination of the two, will always be changing. So there's also the risk that as an archive, you adopt one technical approach, you understand it, and then if you move to another technical approach, you try and take with you those techniques, but they don't transfer across, and you end up introducing more risks. If you make more copies, then the content is, of course, safer, but that brings with it a huge cost. So the raw media cost, drives or data tapes, is only a very small percentage of the total cost of ownership of IT storage by the time you include people and equipment and power and cooling and maintenance and upgrade and so on. And in fact, if you look at the costs of running big data centers or online storage providers or even do-it-yourself costs, it's typically 10 times more expensive, the total cost of ownership of digital storage, than the individual raw media. That cost is falling over time, but it's not falling quite as fast as the media costs. So you can multiply again by a factor of four for the total lifetime costs of storage. And that means making extra copies can be hugely expensive if you've got large volumes of data, which is, of course, why compression is attractive in saving storage costs and having more copies. But then that makes you more susceptible to corruption problems. So the BBC are looking at this from a slightly different perspective of more resilient encoding. So they're taking their Dirac encoder and they're splitting out components of the encoded file into subfiles, each of which can be treated differently depending on how sensitive those components are to data loss. So for example, the DC component is extremely sensitive to loss, so it would need to be stored in a way that protects it quite carefully. Likewise for the low frequency components, but less so for the high frequency components. So you can see that by splitting out a file and storing each of the pieces differently, you have the potential to apply costly techniques to improve safety just to the parts of the content that need it most. And of course, arguably, uncompressed is probably still the safest thing to do. But because of the costs, it's often prohibitive, unless perhaps you're dealing with audio content and then it's fairly standard practice. The challenge here is if you are going to use compression, to only ever use compression once and to pick the format carefully. So by the time you need to migrate from it, you can afford uncompressed. Concealment we heard about yesterday, for example, DV. But concealment only works really because there's a tight coupling between the way the content's encoded, the carrier that it sits on, and how its failure modes, and the machine that it's played back in. And there is no common, well, no equivalent general purpose solution in the IT world, which is maybe a scope for more work. And then finally, checking often, repairing quickly, checksums. The obvious approach here, and many archives already use checksums, but for huge files, if you need to move big files around just to repair very small amounts of corruption, then that's inefficient and brings with it a cost. For example, restoring content from a tape in a deep archive just to correct a couple of bytes of corruption. So here in a UK project, we're taking a slightly different approach of taking very big files and chopping them up into lots of smaller files. For example, separating out the video, the audio, and the metadata components, and then for the video, chopping that in part again. And then you can distribute and replicate just those smaller pieces and check the smaller pieces, which means that when any particular individual piece becomes corrupted, it's much quicker and more efficient to repair it because you're only moving the small pieces around. Just the corrupted pieces need to be repaired, not the whole file. And then finally, and I guess I'm coming up to time, some of the wider issues of IT and storage. And there's more to life to bits. I've concentrated quite a lot on things like data tape and hard drives because they're the most sort of immediately tangible equivalent to items on shelves. But things like checksums or checking files against the syntax, the specifications for them, doesn't necessarily see errors in those files which may come in from other places. So in Presto Prime, Yo and Iam are looking at content-based video quality analysis. This is kind of like the equivalent to some of the audio quality analysis in the whole chain that we heard about from Jörg yesterday. And here it recognizes that problems can come in throughout the whole chain within production, post-production, and distribution. So you need a wider quality QA process, as well as checking the bits. And then just some more risks for you, if you weren't worried enough. What we've done in Presto Prime is taken risk assessment methodologies for trusted digital repositories and combined them with information security risk assessment techniques, which you typically apply to IT systems, to look at the wider range of threats to digital content that come from IT. And we've identified 37 of these risks, many to integrity or degradation of content, the things that you'd expect. But there's also wider risks in terms of being able to protect the capacity you have in IT systems to perform preservation actions. And if you don't have that capacity, or there's contention for that capacity by the need to access and use the content, then that puts the content at risk. And then if you're working with third parties, service providers, or even an internal IT department delivering a solution, then there are risks from a mismatch of expectations on what they need to deliver in terms of preservation. So these are just a few examples of some of those risks, and I won't go into them in any detail here. There's a big report that's just about to be published by Presto Prime that covers all of this. And for each of those risks, we look at where the risks come from. For example, risks to integrity of data, all the things that can go wrong. The things themselves at risk, not just the content itself, but the metadata that describes that content. And that's equally important, because if you don't know what the content is or where to find it, then you've essentially lost it or can't use it. And then a wider set of sort of digital things that you need to protect. The consequences, if there are loss or problems with those digital assets. And then finally, and this is the most useful bit, a set of countermeasures, things that you can do about it, right? So I'd encourage you to at least look at that report if you're interested in the wider issues. And then finally, to conclude, so I've talked quite a lot about the problems of IT storage, and they do exist, and there's a lack of awareness, I think, about a lot of these problems. But equally, there are a range of solutions, but those solutions have a cost associated with them. So it's really a question of trading off what the risks are to content, what it's going to cost you to reduce those risks, against really what the benefits are in the long term of maintaining data integrity. And that's it. And thank you very much. And for more information, please have a look at the Presto Prime websites, and in particular, a couple of big, big, big reports that we have coming out soon. Thank you.
Very interesting. It's if you had an option between going the IT path or deciding to film out key assets, which way would you go?
Hang on, okay, so over there. So the question was IT versus film. I think there's the potential for combining both. I think the IT approach gives you good access for low cost, but not necessarily safety, real long-term safety, where you can guard against the risk of if you do nothing, you can still use the content. Whereas film potentially gives you that, whether you use analog film or printing bits to film. But that's hugely expensive in comparison. So if you can afford it, do both. If you can't afford film, then you've only got one option, and that's to use IT, and you better be sure that you be very active in preservation and ensure that you can sustain that preservation. So I'm not going to recommend one way or other. I'm just saying that there are choices to be made, right?
Hello. Yes, I'm here. I'm from National Film Archive of India. In last 1 year, we have scanned 150 films at 2K resolution and restored also. At the moment, we are keeping two sets of raw scans and two sets of restored version on LTO4 tapes. So after having gone through your presentation, what you would suggest will be ideal to preserve these restored versions?
Okay, so if you've got two copies on LTO tape, then that's pretty safe. Evidence suggests that that's pretty safe. The large archives who've used LTO 2, 3, and 4, and who are now moving to LTO 5, who have held it on data tape in reasonably carefully controlled conditions, and they've had multiple copies, that provided that they know the checksums for the files that they have on that data tape, then when they've migrated between generations, they've been able to identify particular tapes that have been problematic and which the two copies they have are the good copies, and successfully continue migrating it without data loss. So yeah, multiple copies in LTO4, I wouldn't say is a good strategy, right?
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your important and excellent paper. There is one dilemma, I think, however, which I know already that the Presto Prime family is not very fond of lossless compression, with very good reasons. However, in the digital film world, MJPEG 2000 is a standard, and there must be some experiences on that. So I wonder, how could you comment between the discrepancy of a practice which has obviously a successful tradition and your statement?
Okay, so yes, JPEG 2000 isn't established encoding, especially in digital cinema. There is some evidence, although it's limited studies have been done on how sensitive that it is to corruption, but it has been shown to be sensitive to corruption. And there's been even less study on real-world experience and holding JPEG 2000 for relatively long periods of time in IT storage systems. Right? And I think this applies in general, that especially hard disk-based storage is only very recently become used for storing lossless, uncompressed, high-resolution content. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done to really understand in detail the risks.
Would it make a principal difference if you store MJPEG 2000 on a hard disk drive or on data tape?
I would have said data tape is more reliable. The error rates from data tape are lower than the error rates, at least from individual hard drives. With hard drive systems, if you've got multiple copies and you check them often, you repair them often, you can still get high levels of safety, but it's a costly and very active endeavor. Yeah?
Thank you. Have you made any comparisons with, for example, MPEG 50 megabit, which has a high rate of error resiliency, transport streams, for example?
Okay, so there are several things here. There's things like MPEG 2 iframe only, so it's intraframe compression, and that ought to be relatively robust to errors, at least compared with intraframe encoded. There's a lack of study of really the effects of bit corruption on that particular encoding. There's been quite a lot of work actually in MPEG 2 when transmitted over space, right? The packet loss, for example, over networks or transmission, satellite or terrestrial, for example, and correction schemes for that. But there's been a lot less work in the transmission over time using storage technology. And that's an area that's open for a lot more investigation. So in answer to your question, no, there hasn't been much work in that area, at least that I'm aware of, but there needs to be.
Hi. I'd like to point out that, if anything, the world looks so much better in a digital environment than analog. We have just the same problems of obsolescence in our analog carriers, whether it's 9mm film or PCMF1 tapes or quad. We're accustomed to seeing these over equally long periods of time. But we also have the kinds of loss that you're describing, and whether it's a dropout and we lose a line of video, or the kinds of things that we heard about in recovering film tracks, soundtracks off film, that this kind of loss is endemic to our world. And we feel more fearful of the digital environment because we can quantify it, that we can put numbers behind it and say, ooh, this is a really big number.
Yep.
There was a number that came out of the Library of Congress for the storage system that they're planning to build, that over the course of 10 years that they could expect to lose, even after all the error correction, 500 gigabytes of data. And this was a huge number. And I went back to my hotel room and calculated that in a 500-page book, it amounted to a data equivalent to the size of a period. Or as my co-consultant put it, more information goes up in the vacuum cleaner of the reading room in every library every morning. So although these problems are very quantifiable and therefore scary because the numbers are very large, the reality is we can do a whole lot more about it and recover with a much higher level of certainty than we ever would have in analog.
So I'd agree entirely. So in the analog world, archives may be happy with losses in terms of several percent of their collection over, say, a 50-year period. Right, and I've been talking about losses which are in the digital world, which are considerably lower than that. And yes, it may be quantifiable in the analog world, and it's also quantifiable to some extent in the digital world too. It's interesting to compare the way in which loss takes place. So in the analog world, loss is much more graceful. It's, maybe there's some head clogging, you lose some lines, and maybe you can conceal that problem. But the way loss happens is graceful in the sense that you start with something that's perfect and then it slowly degrades into something that's not perfect. The same type of loss doesn't necessarily happen in the digital world. So you can go from having something perfect to having nothing at all, right? And it's that complete switch that's potentially the problem.
But the opposite is true as well, that if you have 100% data recovery, you have 100% of your content, whereas your content in analog fades from day one.
Yes.
Well, that's not if it's black and white. Black and white based stock's not going to fade.
There was one down there first.
Hermann Lewitz, Austrian Mediathek. I'm a little bit irritated about the discussion, how much information you lose when you compress or not compress, because I understood the whole concept of going digital for archive purposes as doing endless migrations and in this way keep our content. But this only works as long as we don't lose any content, any byte. So if we now realize that we might lose bytes in our archive, this is a problem, because this is a problem for the whole concept. So I don't ask how many bytes is missing in my file. I ask how many files do I have to keep to have the statistical chance to have one file which is okay. You understand what I mean? So I shouldn't aim to have the better format, so that the loss is not so big. I should aim to have no loss, because if I have loss, the concept does not work, and I can forget the whole work.
Okay, so in an ideal world, then yes, there should be no loss, and it's certainly a sensible objective to try and achieve no loss whatsoever. But in practice, is it always going to be possible to have no loss, and what's the cost of having no loss?
For example, when you speak about JPEG 2000, which could be nearly a third of the amount of data compared with uncompressed, so it gives me the chance to keep three copies instead of one. So what is a better chance? What is a better solution? To have three copies, but have more loss in if I have a corruption, but I can then change the file, or to keep just one file and have less loss.
Okay, so this is something that we are currently looking at in Presto Prime, to build those models that will give you that quantifiable answer. Because it isn't obvious, at least not to me, that if you do use compression, that you can have multiple you can have more copies for the same money, and that then reduces the chance of losing anything. compared with just one or two uncompressed copies. I think that for me, the jury's out on which one is best. But I think I think more work is needed there. But my gut feeling is that if you can go uncompressed and do it sooner rather than later, as the chances are, for many reasons, that the content will be safer.
I'm a bit concerned with possible kind of misreadings of your study and your statements here in one particular area. Most of your focus is on bit loss or on integrity loss due to compression. But you haven't said anything about loss due to forgetting how to format obsolescence, for instance. So I'd just like you to clarify for some people in the room, particularly the kind of loss. You made some statements about putting it away, LTO tapes, long time. I mean, there's another loss inherent in that in terms of format obsolescence, right?
I'd agree entirely. There's a whole load of risks that come from using particular file formats. And there, for example, if you go to the Library of Congress site, they list a whole range of different file formats, including audiovisual formats. And for each format, they've got, I think it's 7 different sustainability criteria. And if you look at all of those in combination, that gives you an idea of the longevity of a particular file format. And you need to consider issues, for example, tool support, the ability to continue to use that format, things like vendor lock-in, and whether it's protected or encumbered in any way by patents, whether the format is transparent and open, so you can easily go in and see what the format is without having to have special tools, etc. There's a whole load of things that apply to all file formats that present risks to those file formats over time. So I'd agree with you entirely about file formats. It just wasn't the focus of this particular presentation. It's not to say that it's not an important issue. It's actually one of those wider set of risks that I listed very quickly towards the end.
Last question? Just one more question. Part of the challenge also is between the actual archive and the service file, right? Because I hear talk about MPEG and so forth like that. We would not consider that an archive-based file. So you got into the discussion a little bit about splitting files out into separate audio files and multiple layers of video, but do you want to address the concept of having a high-resolution, uncompressed master file somewhere and then have subcopies that actually would be used for access purposes?
Sure. There's the whole issue of the preservation master copy and then all the different resolutions of access copies in contemporary encodings that are useful at the time. But going back to the point you make about things like MPEG not being a preservation format, it's still the case that for born digital content that may be created in a particular encoding, it's still probably the best thing to do is to keep it unchanged in its original format, at least to the point when it's at risk, because that's as close as you ever get to the way it was originally created. So it's not necessarily the best thing to do in the short term to go immediately from a born digital production format into a uncompressed preservation format, at least if that production format isn't currently at risk for any particular reason.
Okay, Martin Körber, Berlin. Thank you very much for that very worthwhile presentation. But I want to stress something that has been said before. Even though the numbers of losses are impressive here to some, if we are honest about our analog world, I think the number of losses that we have there every day would be much more impressive, but we don't account for those, and we have no one doing a risk assessment for those because we take them for granted. How many times, when you go through your inventory, have you discovered that a can has been lost because it didn't come back from a lab, because no one ever checked whether it came back, or no one ever checked whether it is on the right place on the shelf, and it may be somewhere else, but you'll never find it in decades. This happens every day, but we don't account for it. And we don't have risk assessments that tell us how many percentage we lose. How many times have you received a negative which was your unique element back from a lab and has been badly scratched? And we don't account for that either in our reports we give to FIAF every year, because we just don't have a mechanism that records these losses. So let's keep that in mind if we think about these rather minimal losses. And I would agree entirely to the gentleman up there that we have more safety now if we do it right. And of course, we have to do it right. But we didn't do it right so far in the analog world. That we must also state.
Yeah, thank you very much for a great presentation and great discussion.